Welcome. This is Dr. Susan Cobb with Temple of Health Radio Show, and today I'm pleased to have back Dr. Daniel Benor, and we are continuing in the interview of his four-volume series on healing research. Today we'll be speaking about Healing Research, Volume 3, Personal Spirituality, Science, Spirit, and the Eternal Soul. Dr. Benor has actually put together an incredible amount of evidence, as well as the skeptical ideas of what might be going on, the scientific and evidence-based information for a variety of things in this volume. I find it absolutely fascinating, as I am very interested in many of the different things contained in this volume 3 of Healing Research, and I think he has done an extensive review of the current literature and the current ideas about what is actually occurring behind these. There's a theme that goes throughout the chapters that our manifested reality may be only part of the picture, and that there may be other things that we have yet to, observe through our senses that may be occurring to explain the various phenomena that he talks about in this volume. Hi, Daniel. How are you today?
Really good, Susan. And yourself?
Oh, great. Thank you very much for writing this. It's been great reading it, and certainly you, like myself, are quite a student of explaining the unexplainable.
This was actually the hardest book for me to write in the series, because I started out with my training in psychology and then medicine and psychiatry being incredibly skeptical. And I thought I just knew how the world was put together,
right,
with all of my studies. And then I ran into phenomena that I'd never been taught about and couldn't explain.
Well, it's interesting when we find out that we don't know what we don't know.
Yes. Good way to put it.
And you know, really, in the book, I can't remember which chapter, maybe you remember, it talks about how important with spirituality. It's not so much what is written or what we can study intellectually. It is actually much more about what we can experience. So we walk out of the academic world and into the world of actual personal experience, which is why I imagine you called it personal spirituality. It cannot be taught in a classroom or learned from a book.
Exactly, Susan. That's what I struggle with, because like in Zen, they say, when you start to put it into words, you've lost it.
Exactly.
And so my challenge was, how do I share this in a book?
Which is words.
Which is words.
That's true. Well, let's go first through some of the different topics that you are addressing in the book. We've got out-of-body experiences, near-death experiences, reincarnation, apparitions, nature spirits and angels, mediumistic channeled experiences, possession, psychic surgery, religions and healing, mystical experiences, quantum physics converges with the mystical, spiritual healing and spirituality, and then research, a research chapter, chapter 12, and then participatory spirituality, which is what I think we were just talking about, that if you really want to learn about this, you actually have to participate and have the experience rather than just read about somebody else having the experience.
Yeah.
Would you like to go through them one at a time, or how would you like to do this?
Well, first I'd just like to share how I got into it.
Sure.
To give it a bit of a context, because I had to get over my skepticism to go anywhere near it. And in our earlier interviews, you know, I shared how I'd come into an experience of spiritual healing where a young man had a little lump under his nipple that shrank in half an hour under the hands of a Reiki master named Ethel Lombardi. And this was a cure for his lump and a cure for my skepticism in terms of believing that it could happen. But it was only the start of my journey to then let go of my left brain objections and questioning and skepticism. So I read all I could and talked with healers and explored my own healing abilities. As I did this, the healers would tell me, well, it's not me. It's Christ or it's God or whoever they felt was helping them. They're angels. I didn't fault that because I could accept they had a belief system and, you know, who could prove it one way or the other. But the fact was they were able to bring about changes.
Mm-hmm.
And then some of the healers would say, well, it's not me. It's the bioenergies.
Mm-hmm.
And I began to study that, and I could see that, yes, I could sense them with my hands, and there was lots of evidence for that. So I didn't argue with that. But when they started saying, it's not me, it's your grandmother, and she's standing there right next to you, the psychiatrist in me started to say, I don't know about this one.
Mm-hmm.
And so I took off in my usual way of looking for research on spiritual awareness.
Mm-hmm.
The first piece that really struck me, I mean, just floored me, was a review of people's responses, a survey in the American Journal of Psychiatry. Now, this is one of the last places I would expect to find something on spirituality, because they are certainly not a New Age journal.
Right.
They're very conservative.
Mm-hmm.
And in this survey, they asked people who had lost someone close to them, did you ever have the sense that they were still present?
Mm-hmm.
What percent would you think would have said yes?
Well, I know because I read the book.
Okay. Unfair. Okay. So most people, you know, guess that it's a pretty high percent. And indeed, it was 2 out of 3 people
mm-hmm.
who said yes. They either saw them, they heard them,
mm-hmm.
or they just knew somehow that they were still present.
Right.
And they found it extremely comforting. Oftentimes when they talked with them or they heard them, they got the message that life continues after physical death, so no worry. And in fact, life is pretty nice on the other side.
It sure is. It's a lot
so
better than here.
Less to worry about.
That's right.
This I found so impressive that I started talking with people in my practice.
Mm-hmm.
I figured I had little to lose if 2 out of 3 people were likely to say yes.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I found that the percent is probably higher in my practice than in their survey. And I found another thing. I asked people, did you ever tell anyone about it?
Mm-hmm.
Most of them said
no.
No. first of all, because they thought they themselves were losing it.
Mm-hmm.
And second, because they were sure that others would be sure that they were crazy.
Right.
Some of them had told their physicians, their family doctors.
Mm-hmm.
A few of the family doctors put them on medication, thinking that they were psychotic. One of them had told a psychiatrist to hospitalize them.
No. Oh, my goodness.
So here was a psychiatrist hospitalizing a person for an experience that 2 out of 3 people have when they've lost someone close to them.
Right.
This really encouraged me to write my book.
I bet it did.
I want more people to know about this.
Years ago, I think probably over, it was probably at least 8 years ago, I interviewed Botkin on his book on the induced afterlife communication. And I found it fascinating about that we actually implemented this in our clinic. Dr. Greenberg does it. He's a NAEP practitioner. And as you know, is it Dr. Botkin, is that his name?
Yes, I think it's Alan Botkin.
Alan Botkin used Nate principles to induce afterlife communication. And,
yes.
Of course, I had Dr. Greenberg practice on me because I was I wanted to make sure he was able to do it. And then sure enough, I was talking to one of my surgical techs who quit and went to work at another clinic and ended up getting a tummy tuck there, and 3 days later died of a pulmonary embolus in her 30s. And she and I had a long conversation about spirituality and things she hadn't understood, and, you know, why she knew now that I always refused to do that tummy tuck for her, and, you know, things she'd learned on the other side. And basically, it was fascinating. It really worked.
It's
amazing.
Yes.
What a great grief therapy, you know, to be able to talk to somebody on the other side and hear all these details and, you know, all this stuff that, and know that they're fine.
Susan, you're touching on something so important, because unresolved grief is one of the greatest problems that we have personally, also, I believe, in the collective unconscious of humanity.
Yeah, it never ends. I mean, it doesn't heal with time. People say it does, but it doesn't.
My experience is that when it doesn't heal, it's because there are aspects of it that are so painful
mm-hmm.
that people partly hold on to them as buried material, or they distance themselves from it. I call it stashing it away in their inner file drawers,
right?
So that they don't suffer the pain of it.
Mm-hmm. But then it never heals.
Well, when they do that, it doesn't heal.
Right.
I found that with the method that I teach called WHEE, W-H-E-E,
mm-hmm.
it's really so deeply transforming to let go of the old hurts. Because when we don't let go of them, they tend to perpetuate themselves in our lives. Our inner selves create situations in the hope that we will release them.
And they often affect the lungs. Grief
yes.
can affect the lungs. And lung problems affect your life. You know, they usually tend to be a lot more intrusive.
Yes. And I've been so concerned about that I've actually written a free ebook on grief and bereavement
really?
That can be released with WHEE. And it's available on my website. Just WHEE, W-H-E-E, book, .com.
Well, that's really a wonderful tool to have if you're suffering from grief. I've got some, in fact, this morning when I was reading your book, I had a visitation. It was interesting. I had a visitation from a friend who died, who was insistent that I call her husband today. Isn't that interesting?
This is such a wonderful service that the sensitive person can provide, because oftentimes there's unfinished business
mm-hmm.
that with a few sentences can be cleared.
Right.
Or there are unresolved feelings in one of the people where just a little bit of sharing can
yeah.
lighten the load so significantly.
And this
so
person
I
is
I
a,
really, yeah?
Yeah, this person who's suffering is a friend of mine who's a surgeon.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, now I've got something that he can go to. You know, the reference you just gave, your WHEE book.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can just say, well, go here and look at that, and go here and look at that, and here's the tools to release that grief.
Yes. We do have the methods now.
Right.
But getting back to the book, Susan.
Uh-huh.
When I started looking at the different phenomena, I found that they're actually fairly common, many of them. Out-of-body experiences have been reported by up to 18 or 20% of the general population.
Mm-hmm.
So I put that first because it's one of the, so to speak, lighter experiences.
Right. Not so scary. This is near death.
So people, when they are asleep often,
mm-hmm.
or when they're tired, or when they've had an accident, They may go out of body, where they find themselves floating in the air, usually above the scene. And many of them can describe the auto accident, or it may happen during surgery.
Mm-hmm.
So they'll describe the surgeon and what happened, sometimes to the embarrassment of the surgeon,
right,
who may have used some language or said some uncomplimentary things.
Patient's fat.
during the surgery,
right.
And I've had people tell me that when they told the surgeon said, "Oh, which nurse put you up to this?"
Yeah.
Because they just couldn't believe it.
They couldn't believe it, exactly.
But it's a wonderfully door-opening experience for people to know that the consciousness that we hold to be in our brain actually extends beyond the limits of our body.
Right.
Some people actually learn to do this at will. And there's a Monroe Institute where they teach this.
Mm-hmm.
So people can go for a series of training sessions learning how to project themselves outside their body.
Yeah, I actually interviewed the head of the Monroe Institute a couple of times. He's got fascinating information.
Well, the scary thing about this, though, is that the military has picked up on it.
Mm-hmm.
They call this remote viewing.
Right, right.
They have trained people to be spies doing this. So,
and we've interviewed many of them, too, Joseph Monagall and then Russell Targ, who set up the program.
And this is worrisome because, the ethics of this have to be respected if you're ethical.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're not ethical, then no privacy exists if they want to invade it in this way.
True.
So, it's just a word of caution that these things, which many people take to be spiritual, can also be used in a very secular way, sometimes not so pleasant. The next step that I introduce people to is what people experience often as initially an out-of-body experience, which then moves into the near-death experience.
Mm-hmm.
So people then find themselves attracted to a light and going through a tunnel towards a very bright light, which turns out to be a being that is all light and all love and all accepting. They often experience a life review where they very rapidly see every element of their entire life flash before them.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like God is sitting there with a calculator saying, you did these many good things and these many bad things, and we're going to add them up and see, whether you come up plus or minus. It's just a factual review, allowing a person to get a sense of where they've been, what they've done, what they've experienced, following which there's a discussion.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes with the being of light saying, it's really not your time to stay here, you must go back now, or
right,
the person themselves saying, I have unfinished business with my family, my career, or what I came into this life to do, so I feel I really want or need to go back. Whereupon they very rapidly find themselves back in their body.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's almost like it's a reality check. All of a sudden, your priorities get straightened out, and then you get back on purpose.
I've not heard it described that way, Susan, but it absolutely fits as a reality check, reminding us what we're here for in this lifetime.
Because we all come in with contracts.
Yes.
We have soul contracts.
I swear I didn't read the fine print.
I didn't sign up for this.
I don't know how I could have been so foolish.
My spiritual teacher was an expert in trying to figure out how you could change your soul contract. You could renegotiate it. It was kind of like a legal spiritual education.
I didn't know I could do that. My goodness, years ago, I would have applied. Well, the important thing, though, is that people who come back from the near-death experience are deeply transformed.
They certainly are.
They know that death is nothing to fear. They know that there are other realities. They know they can be in communication with other people who have passed on.
Mm-hmm.
Many of them can now communicate with God directly or with spirits or angels
mm-hmm.
at will. So it's a wonderful resetting, you know, of one's life compass.
And then if one isn't so nice, we have the negative near-death experiences, which can be quite scary.
Yes.
Did you ever see the Sopranos episode when Tony's nephew died in the hospital, you know, near-death experience in the hospital after getting shot? And he got sucked under the, you know, down under the gutter in the street and had all these spirits pulling at him?
No, my
goodness. Oh, yeah. That was on The Sopranos. It was interesting. And there was a doctor who wrote a book on negative near-death experiences, a female doctor. I forget her name. But essentially, people who have beliefs, and you said this in your book, fundamentalist beliefs and beliefs in, you know, that you sin and you're forever damned and that kind of thing, they often have near-death experiences that are negative. Or people who are truly evil do.
Yes.
Yeah, they really do. So
yes.
It's kind of interesting that you know, that we hear more about the ones that are of the light, but
yes.
They also exist the other way.
Yes. People have come to call that the fear-death experience.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, and I think I've studied this extensively, and I've interviewed Cindy Dale on her book, Illuminating the Afterlife, which is probably one of the best comprehensive studies of what happens after you die. Basically, for many of us, whatever we believe is going to happen happens first. So if you believe you have to cross the River Styx, you're going to have to cross the River Styx. You know, that was an old-time belief. And if you believe you're going to go to hell, you may go to hell for a while. And then if you believe you're just going to go fishing, because that's what you like to do, you go fishing. And they let you do that for a while, and then pretty soon a few people come along and kind of tap you on the shoulder and say, hey, look, you need to come do your life review. So eventually I think everybody does their life review, like you said. But for a while they can bask in the fourth dimension doing whatever they want to do.
Yes.
One of my patients, who was an OBGYN doctor, got seriously injured and spent a year in the ICU. He told me that he remembered me doing a surgery, which wasn't good because he was awake during the surgery. I had to take his spleen out. I just pulled it out. It was totally avulsed. He was on Coumadin at the time of his injury, so it was a miracle he lived. But anyway, he spent a year in the ICU because he had one of the worst flail chests that anybody had ever seen, and plus a whole bunch of other injuries. And he said he went fishing. He just went fishing. He said, I remember, he told me exactly what I said when I pulled his spleen out, which was, oh shit. One of my other patients one time, I was doing a surgery on him under local, and I dropped a suture, and I said, whoops. And he goes, what does whoops mean? I said, oh, whoops doesn't mean anything. When something really bad happens, we say, oh shit. Just remember that if you're getting surgery. Whoops, I dropped the suture. But anyway, so this surgeon was talking with me right before he got discharged, and he told me he went fishing for a year.
Uh-huh.
Isn't that interesting?
That's lovely.
He didn't wait. He did not come back into his body until he was about to be able to be transferred out of the ICU. So that's, you've heard of ICU psychosis, I'm sure. I'm sure you were called to treat it many a time when you were in training. So, you know, that ICU psychosis is just, they're not there. They're somewhere else.
Yes.
So, and thank God. Isn't that wonderful that we can go somewhere else when our body is totally in, you know, tremendous pain?
Yes.
I think that's great.
Yes, it is.
The real blessing.
A tremendous blessing, yes.
And what he said to me was funny. He said, when you cut my abdomen open, I didn't really feel it because my chest hurt so bad, but I wanted you to hurry up and finish so I could get some morphine for my chest pain. Amazing, huh?
Wonderful. Yes. Well, you know, just looking at the spectrum of experiences, maybe we should let people who are interested read the book to get the deeper details of these, and go on to the next one, which was reincarnation beliefs.
Right.
Now, I put that one next because I felt that it would give a different sense of what happens when people see spirits.
Mm-hmm.
Because many people say that spirits just are somewhere, you know, out there, and it has nothing to do with life actually continuing.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to put a frame around the other experiences. So I put the chapter on reincarnation third.
Mm-hmm.
Here, I was astounded at the persistence of Ian Stevenson and other researchers in tracking down mostly children
mm-hmm.
in third world countries who had reported memories of previous lives.
Right.
They chose to do it this way because in those countries, in the 1970s and 80s, when they were starting this research, there were very few villages that had radios or televisions or newspapers.
Mm-hmm.
Very few of the villagers traveled, you know, outside the borders of their village. So it was fairly certain that if a young child reported a life many miles away, sometimes with details of language,
mm-hmm.
A different dialect, perhaps, naming the village, naming the names of the family members, it was highly unlikely that the child could have obtained the information through everyday sensory channels.
Right.
When
and children aren't likely in that circumstance to be trying to fool anybody either.
Exactly.
They have no motive.
Yes. Although, sometimes they do have motives, and I'll mention that in a moment. In doing this, they found children who could actually, when they were taken to visit the distant village or city, they could actually identify the family members by name and relationship, and then identify intimate family details
mm-hmm.
that no one would be likely to know outside of the intimate family.
Yeah, and where stuff was hidden, you know,
yes.
valuable stuff was hidden as part of
yes.
it, which is really neat.
Yes. But even more interesting were the birthmarks
mm-hmm.
that Stevenson collected that had a parallel with the injuries people experienced either close to or at the time of death.
Right.
So a person would have a birthmark, say, on their chest, and they died because of a chest wound.
Mm-hmm.
So I find the evidence in that way impressive, as
mm-hmm.
well as the evidence from collected series of age regression. Where people, this was done in Southern California by Wambach, I'm forgetting her first name,
mm-hmm.
I think it's Evelyn. She invited people for a group regression, ending up with two series, one of 300 people, another of 800 people.
Mm-hmm.
She found that the reports, when taken collectively, were highly unusual if one would be speculating that the people were just imagining the experiences.
Mm-hmm.
Just as if, for instance, about 80% of her population in Southern California were women. Now, if you were a woman in Southern California coming for your past life experience, if you were making it up, what would you expect the gender to be mostly in the past life? The same or different?
The same.
Yeah, that's what I would expect. Because that's what's familiar to people, that's what's comfortable
mm-hmm.
to people. But in her two series, in each of the series, it was almost exactly 50-50 male
mm-hmm.
and female in past lives. That would be hard to choreograph, if you were faking it. Because these were done in batches of, I think, 30 or 40 people at a time over a period of months.
Right.
And there were other statistical findings that were hard to dismiss as anything but related to actual past life memories.
Mm-hmm.
So the evidence for reincarnation seems fairly suggestive. It's hard to call it substantial because there's no way to actually prove a past life. Because once you know that there's a collective consciousness, then you could be obtaining the information in that way.
Right, that's true. That's a theory that we don't know if it's you know, does the soul fragment and then come back down, or the personality fragment and come back down into multiple people in the next lives, or is it the one-to-one correlation? And are you familiar with Paul von Bord's research in reincarnation?
No, I'm not.
Paul, you ought to look him up. He's got a current experiment ongoing correlating certain things that are evidence-based information for reincarnation. And he wrote a book called, I think it's Science in Reincarnation, where he looks at a huge amount of evidence, kind of what you did plus other evidence that is, and then develops experiments that are currently ongoing to prove his hypotheses. So he's actively working on this.
I'd be very interested.
Paul's great. He's a lovely man. And he wrote God's Genes and Consciousness, which that book blew me away, I'll tell you. That was just a book that was so incredible. So,
how do you spell his last name?
Paul von Bord. I think it's V-O-N-W-A-R-D. If you just look under the reincarnation experiments, his website comes up and...
Okay.
He's actually got ongoing research. And what he's found is that we maintain traits. Like, if you look at Oprah in this lifetime, she's a black woman with kind of a certain facial structure that was born poor. And if you look at who certain people believe that she was before, she was a white male abolitionist around the time of the revolutionary times, who was also born poor. The interesting thing is in both lifetimes, they became very wealthy, and if you turn their pictures upside down, so you can't really, you kind of just look at features, they're the same person. So these things we like, and also like if you really love coffee, you may come in and, as a 5 and 6 year old want coffee. So things that do translate are facial features, body types, the tendency to become rich, those kind of things. But what doesn't is sex, race, religion, and things that we go back and forth and back and forth with those, which is interesting.
It appears that we seek a variety of experiences to have different lessons. And yet
right.
there are some lessons that maybe haven't been sufficiently learned, so we
mm-hmm.
get sent back a class.
That's correct. Like, one of the spiritual teachers was saying that, say you have a desire in spirit at the soul level to learn about religion, well, you would be born, you know, a rabbi, a priest, a Southern Baptist minister, and then an atheist, okay? So you truly go on all sides of the experience to learn about it.
Yes.
So you shouldn't judge people that are atheists. They may actually be great students of spirituality and religion, which I think is a great thing. They talk about overlays. Casey talked about overlays, that somebody might have an overlay of alcoholism or an overlay of ambition because of their mission that isn't actually part of what they came in to learn or do. It's just necessary for the path they're on.
Yeah.
So I always thought, you know, that's why, because overlays exist, we shouldn't judge people. It may simply be an overlay that is necessary. He gave the example of somebody who was destined to be president. If someone's destined to be president, they have to be ambitious. I mean, they just don't get to be, at least these days. I mean, I don't know about the past. But these days, you've got to have that ambition.
Yes.
And so the overlay of ambition may be given to somebody so that they can become president.
Yes. Yes.
So those are kind of the soul contract things that we learn about in the spiritual schools.
What's so important about it, in my view, is that it provides a whole different perspective on what life is about.
Mm-hmm. It does.
Not just for individuals, but for life on this planet.
Right. I do not think that we are going to get through what we need to talk about today. So I want to propose we continue on the way we're doing it, but that we set up another time to take up wherever we leave off. How would that be?
I think that's fine, Susan.
Because I really don't want to miss any of these. These chapters are just so packed with information,
and
I really think it's important to do each one. So we won't have to hurry today. How's that? Is there anything else you'd like to add about reincarnation? I think one of the most important things in the chapter is how most of the references to reincarnation were taken out of the Bible at the Ecumenical Conference in 500 AD. You want to talk about that a little bit? That's extremely important.
The fact is that in Christianity, it was part of the early Christian beliefs, but then by decree, it was proscribed, so that after the about the year 500, I think it was around 500, that the discussion of reincarnation within Christianity was just not encouraged, and it certainly wasn't taught.
Mm-hmm.
So. We can see that religion is not the fixed belief system that we're taught it is, or that we come to believe it is as children, when we're told this is how it is, and that over time it does shift.
Yeah, Jesus was actually raised as an Essene, and that was a Jewish sect. His mother was an Essene, and Mary's mother was an Essene, too. And she actually took Mary to an Essene community to be raised from Ireland because of, she was married to this man who was really mean to her, and so she left with his daughter until he died, and then she inherited all his property. It was pretty neat. But Mary was raised as an Essene, and Essenes believed in reincarnation. They were vegetarians. People who are interested should read the Essene Book of Peace, and there's some other seen things out there, but it's very, very interesting. They did healing. They were clairvoyant. They had all the gifts of the Spirit, and that's how Jesus was raised. So, have you ever heard of the Angel Scroll?
No.
Yeah, it's a document that was found on the Dead Sea. You know, it was part of the Dead Sea Scrolls. And a group of Byzantine monks bought it from the people who discovered it in 1954. It's a 1,000-word document, and only the first 100 words have been translated, but it's believed to be the writings of Jesus. And when I was in Sunday school, I would always ask my Sunday school teacher why nothing Jesus ever wrote got in the Bible. That usually stumped them. But anyway, the reason nothing he wrote got in the Bible was because the angel scroll, which is the one document felt to be written by Jesus, it starts all, it's essentially the first 100 words is about reincarnation. And it's a beautiful, beautiful document. It says, conception is not the beginning, nor is death the end. And it goes on to talk how no baby is born innocent. And it's a real flowery language, kind of like the Course in Miracles, if you know what I mean. It's obviously not written by someone who is just human. It's just way too elegant. And that is never got in the Bible, or if it did, it was taken out. You know, many, many books were taken out of the Bible, as you know.
Yes.
So you've got to study history, and you have to do your own research, and you have to go and try to get your own experiences. When I was exploring reincarnation, it was started out with a feeling. I had a feeling, a funny feeling, whenever I looked at the Mississippi River. It wasn't a pleasant feeling either. So I had a friend of mine do a past life regression on me, and I was a black slave. I was a field slave, and I was running away, and I got shot in the back, and my body was thrown into the river. So, and I'm just as rebellious today. But I'll tell you something, in this lifetime, I can outwork so many people in the physical realm. You know, like dig ditches all day, where they're tired way before I am. Isn't that interesting?
Wonderful.
Yeah. So it's a feeling that will set you on a journey to discovering. A feeling out of place can often be the important clue that you need to do a past life regression. And then once you do the regression, you can understand why you have some particular talents or particular fears. We were helping somebody with a fear of flying, and it turned out, it was just last Sunday, it was a group of us, and it turned out this person had been pushed off a cliff, because when he was a healer, he was the doctor to the queen in I think, Egypt, and the queen fell in love with him, and so he was pushed off a cliff by the assassins of the king. And he, you know, his wife was with him, and she says, yeah, he just gets really, really jittery when he's up in the air. Not when he takes off. I mean, it's not a fear of flying, but when he's up in the air, he's very, very, he's definitely got this phobia. But, you know, a weird phobia, not making sense, is usually due to something in a past life. Claustrophobia, that's usually being buried alive. And how often did that happen? That's got to be a horrible thing. I mean, you can imagine why that transcends lives. I mean, can you imagine being buried alive?
No, thank you.
I mean, I'd rather be hung or even burnt, you know, but be buried. I mean, there were some pretty terrible ways to die.
Yep.
And so I think that's what imprints us so much. And so phobias that don't have a basis in this lifetime, like fear of drowning, when you've never fell into the river or pool and almost drowned, that's probably coming from a previous life. And if you care to explore it, you can get information. It's basically a hypnotic thing that people who are trained in it can take you back, and you can see for yourself. And then you can get details, like you say, and those details can be looked up. I mean, you can get things that you can go look up and prove it to yourself. You obviously don't know these things, and you can prove and see. Some people have even researched, you know, where they were buried and what they did, and you know, who their past people in their life were compared to present. And it's my experience, we only work on a couple of lifetimes each one. You know, each lifetime is a couple of lifetimes that we're trying to straighten out. I mean, we don't do all of them at once, which is good.
Sure. Sure.
So basically, if you study the history and understand, you know, if you understand Jesus' immediate family, they were Essenes, how he was raised, how, you know, his teachings included this, but that that was taken out of the Bible deliberately. And I think it was deliberate because you can't ask somebody to give 10% of the money they make if they've got lifetimes to get it right. What do you think?
Yes.
And it all comes down to follow the money, doesn't it?
Follow the money and the power. Yes.
And the power. That's right.
Yeah. Because the religious authorities maintain themselves as authorities on religion by discouraging personal spiritual
life. Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, is there anything else you want to talk about in terms of reincarnation? We've only got
just to mention that in line with what you've said about people remembering a past life, when there's a symptom in current life that comes up, I find that you don't even need hypnosis many times when a person is connecting through the feelings to what's going on in their life. I believe that our memories, I started understanding this about the current life, but it also applies to past lives. They're filed in file drawers that have feelings on the tabs.
Attached to them, right.
So if a person is into fear, they may go to earlier memories in a current life, but they also may go to earlier memories in a past life of fear that are asking to be cleared. Because I believe when we bury stuff that is uncomfortable, and burying it at the time may be the best thing that we can do as a child or under stress in order not to suffer.
Right. You can't challenge your authority that is also responsible for your survival.
Yes.
Right.
But the problem is that once it's buried, it stays inside, and it festers.
Right.
Because it after a while, it clamors to be released. It's a lot of energy that the inner self expends keeping it buried.
Right.
Keeping it away from conscious awareness. But at the same time, that inner awareness is also conniving to create experiences where we're going to open the same file drawer so that maybe we'll empty it.
Yeah, this happened to me on three occasions. I would meet somebody. The first time I met them, I didn't really have the feelings. But the second time I met them, I had a very, very strong feeling of fear. And fear like I've never, never felt in this lifetime. I mean, a real deep, deep, visceral fear. And then I would have a vision of them killing me. And so... and it's all three of them actually were also aware that they had killed me in previous lives, because they also had the kind of awareness that I have. And some of them didn't get it right away, but one of them I actually left in my house, and I left and drove in my car until I could get the fear released, and then I came back, and then later on he was doing a healing on me months later, and he was doing the healing, and he says, "You've been cut in half." And I go, "Yeah?" And he goes, "I cut you in half." I said, "Yeah?" Well, I was his wife when he was a samurai warrior, and I cheated on him. And in that society, that was, you know, that was, he had to kill me because that was his honor. And so he said, "I am so sorry."
Oh, wow.
But that was so funny because the second time I met him, I actually left him at my house. And I thought he probably thought I was crazy. I said, "I got to get out of here." Then I did all the breathing, you know. I mean, this fear came up, which is tremendous. But now I know why. These three people, one had slit my throat in a previous life when I was a Cathar priest and he was a Catholic priest. And I had the vision of that the minute I saw him for the second time. And then there was a samurai warrior. And then the third one, he was aware he'd killed me accidentally. He had a very bad anger management problem in a previous life and caused an accident that killed me. So for a while I thought all the men I was meeting had killed me in a previous life, but it was interesting because all three men wanted to marry me in this life, but I wouldn't have anything to do with them. I really didn't want to get married to them. But it was basically to allow that fear to release, because I was in a part of my life when I was rapidly getting rid of serious buried fear that I didn't even know I had, honestly. But it sure came up when I met these guys. So that got a lot of fear.
Well, your unconscious is wonderful at choreographing these releases.
Right, it really is. It's great.
Not only, you know, internally, but through the collective consciousness, helping you to meet those people in the
life
you need to meet
in
order
to bring
that
fear up, right.
Raise it and then clear it, yes.
And clear it, right. Yeah. Well, at that time I knew how to clear it, and I was also aware that, you know, that it was probably a past life thing, because these, you know, when you see a vision of somebody killing you and you just met them, it's probably past life, you know, most likely. Either that or you're just insane, you know, you decide which one it is. That's really great. Well, we're coming to the end of our hour, and we've only gotten a reincarnation, but I promise we'll have you back, because I've got to talk to you about psychic surgery and channeling experiences and some of the other topics later on. Would you like to give your contact information once more?
Certainly. People can find my book at the Holistic, spelled with a W, WHOLISTIC, healingresearch.com. website. It's all one word, holistichealingresearch.com.
Mm-hmm.
For the grief and depression on www.paintap, P-A-I-N-T like Thomas, A-P like Peter, paintap.com. And my email is db, my initials, at paintap.com.
I want to thank you so much for being with us. And I also want to mention that I haven't forgotten that I promised to write up that uterine fibroid story. The thing that I'm not ready to submit it, though, because I haven't gotten the follow-up ultrasound, which I think is important for the scientific validation part. And I haven't gotten that, mainly because just time. But anyway, we've been interviewing Dr. Daniel Benora, Personal Spirituality, Science, Spirit, and the Eternal Soul, which is the third volume in a four-volume set on healing research. And we've only gotten partway through this today because there's so much to talk about. Next week, we will have on Marie Jones and Larry Flaxman, The Deja Vu Enigma, A Journey Through Anomalies of the Mind, Memory, and Time. Then on the 4th of December, Tricia McKinnon is back with Jesus, the Explosive Story of the 30 Lost Years in the Ancient Mystery Religions. That, by the way, is where I get much of my information about Jesus, as she did extensive research into his early years. And then we have Dr. John Boyk back on to talk about cancer drug discoveries using natural product mixtures. John has written one of the best books on natural cancer treatment I've ever read. Jeremy Taylor on the 18th, The Wisdom of Your Dreams, Using Dreams to Tap into Your Unconscious and Transform Your Life. And then on Christmas, Dave and Linda Freud will be talking about the healing gift. She is a medical intuitive, and they have written a great book on that. We do not have Noetic Science for December. We're taking a break from that, but we'll be back in January. If you would like to get an email version or an e-version of the newsletter, call 770-457-4677 or email us through the website www.templeofhealth.ws. Well, Daniel, thanks so much for joining us again. I've really enjoyed talking with you and look forward to the remainder of the book. We'll take as many hours as we need to talk about this.
Okay.
But your book is so important for people who are, you know, asking important questions about who they are, why they're here, and what does it mean? Because it isn't meaningless. It isn't. We're just not here to pass time or to work a job so we can retire. We're here for reasons. We're here for soul contracts. We're here for a purpose. And it's only through engaging in that purpose that you're going to avoid the massive depression, anxiety, and other psychiatric problems that seem to plague at least the Western world.
Thank you so much, Susan, for inviting me. It is a pleasure, as always, talking with you.
Okay.
You are so knowledgeable and so experienced, and being a physician, you know, you have a depth of understanding of many of the reflections into the physical world of all of these things. So it's a deep pleasure talking with you.
Well, thank you. Thank you. This is Dr. Susan Kalb with Temple of Health Radio Show. Be sure to join us next week.